Web streaming of 90.3 WPLN-FM is made possible by listener support and by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, the promise of discovery. Learn how you can support this service at NashvillePublicRadio.org.
Says you, Public Radio's game with words played in front of a live audience, a crowd not reluctant to express themselves.
To all those who applauded, I want to express my thanks. To those who booed, I want to applaud your taste. Thank you.
And don't be fooled. Just because it's a word game doesn't mean we don't face difficult existential dilemmas. Neither are correct, actually.
Neither is correct.
Now, I could use this as a great instructional moment for the rest of the country, or I could edit it out. And no one would ever know. So come join us in Vermont, where hospitality reigns. There for the asking.
Gee, could I get an extra night and some more free cheese?
Says you, next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Anti-nuclear protesters are marching in Tokyo today, just ahead of the second anniversary of the deadly earthquake and tsunami that triggered a nuclear crisis. John Matthews in Tokyo reports that demonstrators are up against stiff opposition with a recent victory by Japan's more pro-business Liberal Democratic Party.
More than 10,000 demonstrators hold up signs outside government buildings demanding an end to nuclear power in Japan. Many of them protest weekly. At one point, the Prime Minister's residence found itself surrounded by concerned citizens every Friday night. Now, however, the new election of Japan's relatively conservative LDP to the legislature is putting a damper on hopes for full phase-out of nuclear power. The previous administration had promised an end to atomic energy by 2040, but new Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's cabinet quickly reversed this decision, saying the nearly 50 offline reactors would be restarted once they passed safety checks. For NPR News, I'm John Matthews in Tokyo.
The visiting Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is still planning to meet with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, but a joint press conference has been canceled. Officials say they won't be speaking to reporters together because of security concerns. A Pentagon spokesman says the cancellation is not because of remarks Karzai made today, suggesting the U.S. and the Taliban are working together to frighten Afghans into thinking violence will worsen if most foreign troops leave as planned by the end of next year. The losing candidate in Kenya's closely watched presidential race says the election was tainted, and he's refusing to concede. As NPR's Gregory Warner reports, this time he's taking his dispute to the courts instead of the streets.
The last time that Raila Odinga lost a presidential election was 2007. He said the election was stolen and the process rigged, and much of the international community agreed. The allegations triggered a cycle of tribal violence that left more than 1,000 dead. This election, Odinga lost again in what he calls a process fouled by rampant illegality. But this time, Odinga urged his supporters not to commit violence and to respect the rule of law. He's taking his case to Kenya's Supreme Court. It's not the only court case against the president-elect, Uhuru Kenyatta. He faces accusations of crimes against humanity for bankrolling revenge killings in the last post-election violence. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
In South Africa, the government says there are no updates today on the condition of Nelson Mandela, the 94-year-old former president and anti-apartheid leader. Mandela was taken to a hospital in Pretoria this weekend and spent the night there. Presidential spokesman Mac Maharaj says he was admitted for a medical checkup.
Doctors are conducting tests and have indicated thus far that there is no cause for any alarm.
Back in December, Mandela was hospitalized for nearly 3 weeks. He was treated for a lung infection and underwent a procedure to remove gallstones. This is NPR News. Voters in the Falkland Islands are deciding whether to remain a British-ruled overseas territory. They're heading to the polls today amid renewed tension between Britain and Argentina. The vote is aimed at countering Argentina's claim over the islands. The two fought a brief war over the Falklands more than 30 years ago. Results are expected after polls close tomorrow night. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says there could be two or three times the current number of Syrian refugees by the end of the year if the civil war isn't reined in. Antonio Antonio Guterres was speaking in Ankara today. The UN says the number of Syrian refugees in neighboring countries has topped 1 million. Residents of a village in South China say police launched an assault this morning. It's the latest move in a clash between the government and rural farmers over a government land grab. As NPR's Frank Langford reports, 3 villagers were apparently arrested, at least 30 injured, and police removed signs demanding democratic elections.
Riot police entered the village of Shangpu firing tear gas. Farmers fought back with bamboo poles before being overwhelmed, according to one resident. Police tore down a tent city and removed nearly 30 destroyed vehicles from an earlier clash, but then retreated, leaving the farmers in control of their village. The assault follows a more than 2-week-old standoff between villagers and police. Farmers say their village chief secretly sold their land for a factory and then sent in thugs to crush the opposition. But the farmers beat up those thugs and took control of Shangpu. Reached by telephone, an employee at the GSG County government office said he knew nothing about the police action. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
The opposition in Myanmar has shaken up its leadership, but it's keeping Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi at the top. Suu Kyi was unanimously reelected to her leadership post today, wrapping up a 3-day party congress. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, proud sponsor of StoryCorps, preserving history and celebrating American lives.
Welcome to Says You, a game of bluff and bluster, words and whimsy.
Support for Says You in Vermont comes from the good folks at Vermont Public Radio and the Basin Harbor Club, celebrating 125 years of hospitality on the shores of Lake Champlain. On the web at basinharbor.com.
Now, join our panelists and your host, Richard Schur.
Thank you. Thank you. From the Basin Harbor Club on the Vermont shores of Lake Champlain, welcome to Says You, a simple game with words played by 2 teams, the first of which sits stereo right. He, in endless error hurled, the glory, jest, and riddle of the world, Mr. Barry Nolan. She, her beauty makes this vault a feasting presence full of light, Francine Akbar. And though I often beat and flay him by the living God what made him, he's a better man than I am, Tony Khan. A little poetic there.
Richard, you can really write.
Yeah. Who's the captain this week?
Your better half for this game only.
Mr. Khan.
Yes.
Well, captain. To my left, team two, he's not the man I thought he was. No, that was someone else. Murray Horwitz. She's not that ponytailed little girl I used to know in Scranton. No, that was someone else. Lenore Shannon. And she's not the kind who'd kiss and tell. No, that was someone else. Miss Carolyn Fay Fox. And who is the leader this week?
Ms. Someone Kiss else.
Someone else. Who'll be the leader? Carolyn will lead. Correct answers are worth 10 points or whatever fraction thereof deemed appropriate. We always advise new listeners to bring a pen and paper. Let's begin with a round of definitions and derivations. For 5 points, define, and for an additional 5, try to divine the origins of the following common words and phrases. Carolyn, Velcro.
Velcro is that wonderful, spongy, sticky stuff that makes sneakers possible for small children.
Yes, that's true.
It's why none of our kids can tie their shoes. Is really that too.
Where would it have come from? That's 5 points.
Is it made
velvet
from two words,
velvet and crochet?
That's pretty close.
Crocheting.
Okay. Velcro was invented for another purpose, was it not? It was invented by accident for the purpose that we use it today. was not what it was originally intended for.
No, actually, it was always intended to be a fastener of some variety. But Murray's real close to the derivation.
All right, velvet and crochet. Let's see. So is crochet correct?
Crochet is correct.
Crochet hook, needle.
And okay. It's actually, you know what, I'm going to give you 10 points, because you went a long way on that. It is the fastening system, of course, of Swiss engineer Georges de Mestrel, I guess, who named the nylon fastening after velour crochet in French for velvet hook. Tony, try this one. Definition and derivation of a movable feast.
Oh.
Well, that is a phrase that came from, it was used by Hemingway.
It was.
For a nonfiction account, reminiscence or a memoir of his time in Paris and the drunken behavior of F. Scott Fitzgerald. A movable feast, it probably, like many of his titles, was borrowed from some other source, maybe the Bible?
Not precisely the Bible, no, but it does have a religious connotation, certainly.
It was the very first celestial pizza delivery service.
Well, first, can you give me the definition?
A movable feast, it was like an ongoing party, basically.
Well, all right, something
you know, a celebration
would go from place to place.
Goes. We're a movable feast.
Yes,
I think
yes.
Says you is a movable feast.
Yeah, from moving from place to place, from zip code to zip code.
And they drank a lot. The Hemingway crowd.
They may have. Now this does have roots in religion.
There was a religious procession.
Yes.
That would go from place to place and ask for food and beverage as a sign of.
Redemption,
and you won't sue them.
There was actually...
You know, I rode that one right off the rails, didn't I?
None of this. Not to beat around the bush, Richard. We have no idea.
You have no idea.
Yeah.
Anyone want to try it on the other side? I'm going to give you 7 points, five for the definition, two for getting to the religious significance.
Maybe it's take out communion.
Take out communion. let's make that 6 points instead of seven.
Are we talking New Testament?
Not really. It's not biblical per se.
Okay. Mm.
Does anyone have any help on the other side? And really, give them 7 points. That's fine.
Did it have anything to do with the Crusades?
Not really. Anybody want to take a guess in the audience?
It's a holy day feast, the day to which changes from year to year.
That's exactly right. Wow. From the front row.
Sounds like Pastor.
I don't know if you heard that. Think about Ash Wednesday, which must always be, of course, on a Wednesday. That means each year it's going to be on a different date. And movable feasts were holy days that were always held on the same day of the week, but therefore had different dates each year. So they had to move. And that's where that came from.
So but Passover is a movable feast.
Passover is a movable feast.
Yes.
It is. Try this one, Murray. I don't know if you'll get it, but I love finding this one out. Definition and derivation of piping hot.
Ooh. Wow. Well, I think of piping hot as something with steam coming off of the plate.
Yes, that's right.
And I'm thinking that the steam has something to do with the piping.
It does. I can't believe he's moving pretty hot.
So maybe it looks like a pipe with smoke coming out of it. Piping hot means something that is so hot that it's steaming. And
yes.
It's sort of like my agent when I call him. But let me think. So you're piping, any help
a
here?
A radiator?
Well, steam pipes.
Steam pipes? No, I wouldn't think so. But
you know, you're dancing all around it. You're getting close to the
pipe.
It's not just that. I will say this. It some say that it resembles the sizzling sound or the whistling of a kettle. So when a liquid is piping hot.
Oh, it's piping up.
Yeah,
right.
It came from
it.
The kettle. But can
it,
you think
it.
Of what we're talking about when we're talking about pipe?
So it's not a tobacco pipe.
No.
No.
Is it a musical pipe?
It is absolutely
good for you.
A musical pipe.
Oh,
I'm going to give you
right.
the 10 points
Thank
for that.
Right.
Very nice.
Does this have to do with the way when you properly serve haggis, the bagpiper comes out preceding it?
He's not far off because bagpipes are involved in this, but it is from it means very hot and sizzling. From 1300s England, it refers to the sound emitted by pipe instruments, the very high pitch of piccolos, recorders, flutes, and bagpipes, whose highest pitches resemble the sizzling sound from hot platters. And that's where that supposedly comes from. Oh,
run,
another room.
Clyde, run, the pipes are coming.
We got another roux. What do you know? Try this one, Francine. Definition and derivation of to fill the bill.
To fill the bill is to provide something that is just exactly what was wanted.
That's exactly right. 5 points.
Bill of lading?
The stage.
Yes, it does come from the stage. Can you be any more specific?
In vaudeville,
here's our
like
theater historian.
Okay.
In vaudeville, in order to really book a full house, you needed to have a top banana or a second banana, and the Yiddish man, who was a guy that did accents.
A stripper? So,
no, that's true. That's
and
true.
So you, one of the things you needed to round out the week's worth of variety acts was you needed to fill the bill. You needed to get that draw in there, that star.
That's exactly right. So I'm pleased to give you 10 points for that. It refers, of course, to the handbills, the posters and the handbills that theatrical companies, when they were coming to a town, would hand out. And the star performer's name was featured in the largest letters possible to attract attention, often crowding out the other supporting players, because his name was what was needed to fill the bill. And that's where that comes from. All right, try this one, Lenore. Definition and derivation of propaganda.
Well, propaganda is written and spoken garbage used to advance a particular cause. That
garbage,
has
that's
no
the word I'd have used, yes. That's, but yeah. That's 5 points, that's
okay.
Right.
And where did it come from?
There's a great James Thurber story where there's a called The Very Proper Gander, where there was a gander living in the neighborhood, and the other people, this is one of his fables, and he said, well, there is a very propaganda, and then somebody said, they said something about propaganda, and so they were hounded out of their homes and burned. And,
is it an Italian word, or is it from the Latin?
It is an Italian word.
It's an Italian
propaganda.
Word.
Propaganda. In order to further the agenda of something. Propaganda.
And
agenda.
That's exactly what this did.
Propagate.
As in propagate is exactly right. Can you think of what was being propagated?
Bad information.
No, not in this
good
case.
Good information.
The point of view of the king.
It wasn't the king.
Uh-oh.
No, this goes back a couple of hundred years. It wasn't a king.
The revolutionaries, the party, the rabble, the
the hoi polloi.
No?
In Italy.
So in Italy.
100 years in Italy.
200 years in Italy.
A doge.
The Pope.
The Pope is exactly right. I'm going to give you the 10 points.
Well, why isn't it the Popeganda?
Yeah, Popeganda.
Pope, no.
Popeganda.
It is the root, of course, for propagate. It is the spreading of rumors, innuendos, and doctored information to promote a cause is propaganda. And strangely enough, it's from Pope Gregory XVIII's Congregatio de Propaganda Fide, a congregation for propagating the Christian faith, in 1622. So that's the root of that. And Barry, try this one. We're going to get a lot of letters on this. There's going to be a lot of argument, but I did do some research on this, so let's see what happens. Definition and derivation of hit the wall.
Oh. Hit the wall means to basically come to the end of your strength, to be able to make no further effort because you have exhausted your resources.
That's exactly right. 5 points.
And hit the wall. They talk about in the Boston Marathon, you hit the wall at the bottom of Heartbreak Hill, but it's got to mean something else. It doesn't
well,
come
you
from
know what?
Baseball, does it?
No, before you go any further, that is the derivation that we found from 1970s Boston. It is exactly about getting to the bottom of Heartbreak Hill. Now, before the...
Not running into the green monster?
No, before I get, 400 letters from every corner of the country, there's a lot of debate about this. And we got everything from test pilots hitting the wall to crash dummies hitting the wall, everything. But it really seems to come from 1970s Boston, where the 18 to 20 mile mark of the marathon, where most people falter, is the start of Heartbreak Hill.
And what's the metaphor about the wall?
It's seemingly a wall right in front of you when you hit that heartbreak.
Oh, there's Stuart.
Virtual wall.
Stuart can probably fill us in on this. Francine's husband, who's this wonderful physician. But there's some method of energy production in the muscles that involves ATP, and that typically most people, when they have totally exhausted the ability of ATP to normally metabolize glycogen into energy, it happens somewhere around, even when you're really fit, around that 18-20 mile thing, and then you begin to have to generate energy in a new way, and it's physically very uncomfortable.
The Italian term is pupaganda.
Do we have any marathon runners in the audience?
Pupaganda.
I'm sure we're going to get a lot of comment on this.
Auto racing? People have been hitting the wall in Indianapolis for
years.
Yeah,
I know. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of comment from the radio audience, and we welcome it. Write in, tell us what you think. That was the best that we could find and the most reliable source. Let's go on to round two, which is played with a little musical help from our friends, the Will Patton Ensemble. It's the first of today's Says You Bluffing Rounds. Carolyn, each of you will receive a card defining a word. Only one has the actual definition. The others have cards that say, please bluff. Those poor souls have a few seconds to make up a definition on the spot, good enough to fool Tony's team. 10 points are up for grabs to Tony, if he can identify the truth teller, or to you, Carolyn, if he can't. A few seconds to come up with a definition for the word Natkin. N-A-T-K-I-N, Natkin. Gentlemen? Statements stops in the Green Mountains of Vermont Saturday, April 20th, for a live performance of the show. It's Stow It, an alpine evening of quips, quotes, music, and wordplay at the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center in Stow, Vermont. Tickets, information, and details are available at sayou.net. That's SAYSYOU. Where if you follow that Join the Fun link, we promise to show you how to join the fun. So remember, that's Saturday, April 20th, at the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center in Stow, Vermont. Come share an alpine idol with the gang from Says You. Says You returns after this from home. Sesquiannual return to Seattle, Washington, as part of this spring schedule of live performances. On June 22nd and 23rd, we'll become Soulcesters as we once again invade Town Hall with special guests and musical surprises. Tickets, information, and details for these matinees are available, of course, at saysyou.net. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U. Where if you follow that Join the Fun link, we'll show you how to join the fun. Other dates for this spring will be posted in the next few days on the site, and we hope you'll keep your eyes peeled to see if this is the year you'll be able to catch a live performance of the show. And who knows, maybe we'll find out who first peeled one's eyes.
Squirrel nut can stay neat.
That is the Will Patton Ensemble. Help me thank Will Patton on the mandolin, David Gusakov on the violin, Clyde Statz on the bass, and Dono Shabner on the guitar. Thank you, guys. Nice job. Let's take a moment and thank our scorekeepers. That is Mr. Carl Crawford on the occasion of his 11th birthday.
Look, Carl.
Ably assisted by Mr. Benjamin Scher. Thank you very much, guys. For keeping the score.
It's wonderful to be here. I have always, having been in all 50 states, I've always said that my two most favorite states to like look at are Wyoming and Vermont.
Yep.
And there's just one complaint this time, and it's partly the Basin Harbor Club and partly the state of Vermont. There's just not enough to eat.
You noticed that.
And I would like to thank the Basin Harbor Club for two uninterrupted days of cheese. I cannot be allowed to be anywhere near another piece of cheddar cheese. I ate such an unconscionable amount of food for lunch. I think I may take a nap right now.
Had to do a lot of announcements.
You promise, remember.
We have had a few moments with the word Natkin. We will go first to a smiling Carolyn Fay Fox.
Well, first I thought Natkins might be little bugs that assault you in the woods. But they're not.
They're not. No.
They're not.
Well, too bad.
You know, you see moose crossing signs all over Vermont, but I was really intrigued by the osprey. I wanted to see one here. You know, they're beautiful. They're huge birds. They mate for life. They build nests the size of a sheep. They're very intrigued. I've not been able to see one yet, but I do know that a Natkin is a baby osprey.
Oh.
A Natkin is a baby osprey. That could be. Or it could be something else. What say you, Murray?
It's actually a glasses case that somebody's left behind, but nobody knows who it belongs to. At first, I thought it was anybody related to Mr. Hawthorne. But...
How quickly they turn!
Boo!
You're running a hot streak here.
No, I am not qualified, really, to say anything about the derivation of this, because I'm supremely ignorant when it comes to the rite of baptism. And apparently, I guess in some earlier time, maybe Victorian times, this was the garment that was placed on a baby when you brought her or him to the baptismal font, and I guess it was rubberized.
The baby was rubberized?
Yeah. A wetsuit for the Christmas.
A neoprene for the neopreme.
A baptismal garment, can we leave it at that?
Sure.
Okay. Lenore, what's your take?
A napkin is a foul thing. When you're walking behind a restaurant and you smell a dumpster that hasn't been emptied in a couple of days, or your garbage disposal that you put some fish down the night before and didn't quite grind up, it's a bad smell.
A foul aroma, a bad smell is a napkin. It could be that. It could be that baptismal garment that we heard about earlier. Or it could be a baby osprey. It's one of those three, and the choice, Tony, belongs
to you.
Well,
how interesting. Choice, you say?
Yeah.
Well, rubberized, let's start with the rubberized. I can imagine a baptismal garment, but I but not a baptism. No,
that was my invention.
Hold on.
You think? Are you kidding? Are you going to stop at that one?
No, I just want you to think for a minute.
Why break a hot streak?
I think the rubberized could be
a napkin,
an embellishment.
Barry,
I think that the rubberized part was kind of an embellishment.
Yes, yes, it definitely was. Is that part that goes over the stomach, the embellishment?
I think there's a good chance it could be the baby osprey.
I do, too.
And I know Carolyn was out there looking for one.
Yeah, there was just
the baby diaper, whichever.
There was a certain intensity that came over Carolyn when she was giving that definition that usually comes from not having lunch, but in this case, it might have been from being with the truth, because I've never heard of an ospretino, you know, an ospretet, so it could very well be a napkin. How about number one? What do you say?
The osprey?
Baby osprey?
I'm fine.
The baby osprey?
Okay. But it's a chance it could be the baptismal garment, but I go with the osprey.
All right. We're going to go with the osprey, Richard.
Carolyn, they have come to the conclusion that the napkin is the baby osprey we all so long to see. Is that, in fact, what it is?
I don't know what you call a baby osprey, but napkin is not it.
So that was a bluff. All right, audience, it is now your turn. What do you think? How many say the baptismal garment? How many say the foul aroma? Well, I think that, Murray, the baptismal garment is winning out here. Is that, in fact, what a napkin is?
Please make something up.
Please make something up. Which means that the real definition is...
Something's rotten in Denmark over here. A bad taste or smell.
Is a napkin. 10 points for Carolyn's team.
Well, well. As we defer,
yeah.
Let's go on to round three. Lynn Stewart of Fredonia, Pennsylvania. Hail Fredonia.
Land of the brave.
There you go. Here's us courtesy our good friends at WYSU in Youngstown, Ohio. She recently wrote, "When seed catalogs arrive, we love to notice creative names for the varieties of plants."
Uh-oh.
We play a guessing game that starts out with a beautiful poetic name and ends, of course, with the common variety. How fast can you name that veggie?
Name that veggie.
Carolyn?
Yes.
Start off with Boxcar Willie.
Boxcar Willie, would that be...
Did you start off with Boxcar Willie?
Yeah.
Way back, I started off with Boxcar Willie. Is that a tomato?
Oh.
It sure is.
Did you know that?
That was a pretty good guess, I got to tell you.
Wow.
Boxcar Willie, a mortgage lifter. Aunt Ruby's German green, Ponderosa red, and beefsteak.
Yeah. Right.
All kinds of tomatoes.
But no big boys. We have big boys.
Mortgage lifter. That's pretty creative.
A mortgage lifter, really. Oh. Try this one, Tony. Mm-hmm. Red sails.
Red sails. Well, must got to be lettuce.
It is exactly lettuce. They're just going to... They're going to crunch through this one. Red sails, Esmeralda, oak leaf, butter crunch, and iceberg. Of course, are all types of lettuce. All right, well, then we'll make them harder. Try this one, Murray. Black turtle.
Black turtle.
Black turtle?
It's a mushroom? Yeah, it sounds like a mushroom. We'll guess mushroom.
Oh, eggplant.
No, neither are correct, actually.
Neither is correct, Richard.
How about...
Now I
could
take this. Now I could use this as a great instructional moment for the rest of the country, or I could edit it out. And no one would ever know. Neither is correct. To black turtle add brown Dutch.
Sounds like a heck of a basketball game.
Yep.
The Black Turtles against the Brown Dutch.
Tobacco is a great guess. It's not
let's
correct.
Say a rarely eaten vegetable.
It's a Brown Dutch and Black Turtle.
Yeah.
Right, we'll go with potato for this one.
It is not. Okay. To Black Turtle, Brown Dutch, add Calypso.
Quiet.
Beans?
Dry beans is exactly right. 6 points. Very good job. To that, we could have added cannellini and Great Northern, but you did not need that. All right, try this one, Francine. Honey select.
Honey, corn.
Oh, my goodness. 10 points. Corn is exactly right. Wow. They know their beans here, I got to tell you. Honey select, peaches and cream, bodacious, silver cream and butter and sugar are all different kinds of corn. Try this one, Lenore. Purple haze.
Purple haze. I know what that is, though. Yeah. It's not. No, I know what it is. Is it basil?
Oh, no, it is not.
Is it chard?
No. To purple haze, add pot of gold.
Oh, is that?
Pot of gold.
Yeah, no, pot of gold.
No, purple haze. Is it potato? Peppers?
No.
No. I know what it is. And
me
I
too.
Just can't,
you know what it is?
Well, then say it.
No,
Lenore.
I don't remember what it is.
No, I don't remember what it is.
Knowing and remembering are two different things.
Boy.
Cabbage?
Nope. To purple haze and pot of gold, add thumbelina.
Oh.
Darn it.
All know it and we can't remember it.
Thumbelina, wait. It's like thumbelina.
Is it carrots?
It's carrots.
Very good.
6 points, Carolyn.
Good.
Nice job. And finally, Barry, try this one. Name that veggie rattlesnakes.
How appealing.
Rattlesnakes?
Rattlesnakes.
Cream corn.
Succotash.
Peppers.
Cucumber.
Peppers.
No, very.
Peppers?
Good guess, no. To rattlesnakes, add straight and narrow.
Green beans.
That is exactly right. 8 points. Good job. Fresh beans, actually, but yeah. You did not need Jade, Kentucky Wonder, or Stringless Blue to get those beans. And very good. And I'd like to thank Lynn Stewart of Fredonia.
That was fun.
Hail Fredonia.
Hail Fredonia for that category. Thanks, Lynn. That was fun.
Wasn't Stringless Blue that banjo player who had no instrument?
No, that was Boxcar Willie, actually.
That's right. Let's go on to round four, which is Tony's team's chance to have a little fun at Webster's expense. One of you will correctly define the following word. Two will bluff. 10 points, Carolyn, if your team can find the rose among thorns. Take a few seconds to come up with a definition for the word pulvinar. P-U-L-V-I-N-A-R. Pulvinar. Gentlemen?
Pulvinar.
We meet again.
A quick reminder, Says You's spring tour, Northern Tier Statements, stops in Stowe, Vermont, Saturday, April 20th, for a live performance of the show at the Spruce Peak Performing Arts Center in Stowe. Then it's off to Seattle, Washington, for dueling matinees, Saturday, June 22nd, and Sunday, June 23rd, at Town Hall, Seattle. Tickets, information, and details are available at SaysYou.net. That's SaysYou. So come join us in Stowe, Vermont, or Seattle, Washington, for a live performance of Says You. Briefly, Says You pauses. We'll be right back.
so many ways to enjoy, says you. You can listen here each week, as we hope you do. You can attend the live performance or download any show in our archive. You can contribute a question to the show and achieve limited fame with a small but dedicated audience. And now there's the book, Says Us, Volumes 1 and 2, a tome of games for family and fellow travelers. All this and more at SaysYou.net. SaysYou. Ensemble. Thank you very much, Will, for getting the guys together for this. That was just lovely. We have had a few moments with the word pulvinar. We will go first to Tony Khan.
Not pleasant.
Not pleasant?
Not pleasant.
Okay.
Well, let me go back a few years. I used to write a children's show called Zoom on public television, and we... could I get an extra night and some more free cheese?
No, but actually it was known in Vermont as Moose.
Moose. And we did one little routine that was about the longest words in the language, and we'd have this poor person in the art department have to write out these words on these long plastic strips that the kids would then run through the studio with. The longest word that we could come up with at the time, I'll never forget it, was the word for black lung disease, which is pneumono ultramicroscopic silicovolcanoconiosis. Just so happens.
Longest word in the third.
Just so happens that pulvinar, or pulvinar, whatever, how was it spelled? Pulvinar?
Pulvinar.
Pulvinar. Pulvinar is a chalk lung disease. I don't exactly know what the symptoms are. It sounds like lung stones of some kind or other.
Lung stones.
Probably from inhaling too much chalk. So pulvinar.
A chalk lung disease.
I'm sorry, but it's true.
A chalk lung disease.
Chalk lung.
You inhale too much chalk, you get pulvinar. Could be that.
People who play professional hopscotch.
You got to look for occupational hazard.
In humid climates.
Or teachers.
Teachers.
Or let's go for another alternative. What say you, Francine?
Well, pulvinar is kind of a downstairs, upstairs, plebeian, upper class mixture. It is a bleacher seat with a cushion on it.
A bleacher seat with a cushion on it.
Yep.
Poor man's recliner.
Exactly. Exactly. You want to sit in the cheap seats and be comfortable, you get a pulvinar.
You get a pulvinar.
Yep.
Cheap seats, all right. Well, it's possible. Or it could be yet a third alternative. What say you, Barry?
A pulvinar is the tip of the epiglottis. You have probably, if you've taken these long trips on the interstate, you've probably seen the familiar bumper sticker on the backs of trucks. If you can see my pulvinar, you're following me too close.
Saw a couple of those on the way up, actually. It's the tip of the epiglottis is the pulvinar. It could be the bleacher seat with the cushion on it, or it could be the chalk lung disease. It's one of the three, and the choice, Carolyn, yours.
I think we need a fourth choice.
Really?
You know, I can't imagine that I would not have heard the word somewhere in a teacher's negotiation, you know.
Pulvinar?
Yeah. We want extra time off for pulvinar.
Yeah.
I think there is a disease, though, for when chalk you want to eat chalk.
Pica.
Yes.
That's pica, though.
So,
but that's eating it. That's not inhaling it.
That's for chalk stomach, not chalk lung.
Right. And I think he was going with that because PUL is like pulmonary.
I just have to think that everybody's got an epiglottis, and presumably every epiglottis has a tip. And if I... So I have one, and if I have one, I would know about it.
But would you know what it was called?
Oh, but you know what? Paul is lung.
Yeah. That's why he did that.
But that's why he did that, yes.
Well, yeah,
why not pulvinaritis? Orosis.
But it... All right, so a bleacher seat with a cushion. Francine does not go to the sports deck very often.
And it's so random. It's so, like, stupid that it just may be correct. No, I mean, that's good. She did a great job.
A bleacher seat with a cushion. I
think there are good reasons to think that it's not chalk lung and good reasons, to me, to think that it's not the epiglottis tip.
So then we'll go with Francine?
Yeah.
We'll go with Francine.
And we'll make fools of ourselves again.
They have finally come to the conclusion, Francine, that pulvinar is a bleacher seat with a cushion on it.
No, we want to discuss it more.
Okay. Is that in fact what it is?
Pulvinar, a cushioned seat in the bleachers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 10 points. For Carolyn's team. Let's close with a round from our 20th century yearbook. We'll give you the notable events and occurrences of a particular 20th century year, one at a time. You know the drill. The sooner you guess the year, the more points you'll amass. Try this one, Carolyn.
Are we talking years in color or black and white?
Yeah, let's see. Try this one, Carolyn. What year is involved here? The visionaries at the Wham-O Company produced the first Frisbee.
1950-something?
Well, you got to be specific in these instances.
1957.
I'm sorry?
1957.
I don't believe she got it. Boy, that was pretty good. 1957, you didn't need the International Geophysical Year or Sputnik, so you didn't need any of that.
Sputnik? Is that where they send a basketball player up?
Yeah. Well, quite some call it Sputnik, I call it Sputnik.
Sputnik.
Try this one, Tony. What year is involved here? The Supreme Court rules that bootleggers must pay income tax.
Bootleggers must pay income tax.
Let's get 90. To Prohibition.
Oh, that kind of bootlegger. I thought CDs. I'm sorry.
You know what? Maybe it is.
Well, when was Prohibition?
1919. I love that. The Supreme Court ruled that bootleggers have to pay income tax.
Pay income
tax. So when you're doing
so it's after Prohibition.
1923.
No, but then it wouldn't be bootleggers. 1928.
1928 is not correct.
1923.
You only get one guess.
Oh.
I can't believe it, though. The Supreme Court rules that bootleggers must pay income tax. Trotsky is expelled from the Communist Party.
1931, wasn't it?
It is.
Oh, that's when he went into... That's when he fled to Turkey.
Right.
To Prinkip Island.
Say that again. Trotsky what?
Trotsky is expelled from the Communist Party.
Well, he wasn't expelled from the Communist Party. He's thrown out of the country. He was still a communist.
Well,
from the party.
Yeah. It's expelled from the party then.
It didn't feel like a party to him anymore.
I didn't know.
He wasn't having a good time.
No.
It was in the 1930s.
1933,
maybe?
No, it is not.
How many guesses did they get?
And then we go to the Supreme Court rules that bootleggers, Trotsky expelled from the Communist Party, Lindbergh flies the Atlantic.
Oh, 1927.
1927 is right. And they guessed 28 on the first one, so that was really tough. But give them 5 points. Give them 5 points for that.
I really want to question the Trotsky thing. I do.
All right. Well, we'll find out. We'll get mail, I'm sure.
I want to change my major again.
All right, Murray. No one else but you has a shot at this, but I figured I'd give it a chance.
I have to stipulate something. I forget everything between 1967 and 1973. So just. I have no recollection.
All right. Murray, try this one. The year involved? Willie McCovey, famously lines out to Bobby Richardson.
1962.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Oh, my goodness gracious. To end the World Series with men on base, it was also James Meredith registers at the University of Mississippi and John Glenn orbits the Earth, 1962. But you didn't need any of those. Try this, Francine. The cherry blossom trees arrive in D.C. from Japan.
Ooh.
This is a tough one.
After the war? Is it a peace sign, maybe?
No, it was before World War II.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe just before Pearl Harbor, huh?
Yeah.
What do you
keep
think?
Keep watching the trees.
What do you think?
Let's see. How about...
Well, what date would it...
That would be in the first two decades of the century.
I mean, wouldn't
century.
It have to have some specific significance in terms of Japanese-American relations? Otherwise, it's so completely out of nowhere.
It does.
You
know,
how about
1939 1941?
No. I'm going to go.
This is in the first two decades.
I think you're right, Barry.
Take a shot.
19.
Russo-Japanese War.
23.
It is not 1923. Good guess. To the cherry blossoms arriving, and the Boston Red Sox won the World Series.
Oh come on, guys.
No.
Come on, guys.
Don't jump to conclusions.
They won the World Series.
1919.
No.
2004.
Well, they did, but it's not a 20th century year, but other than that.
They weren't called the Red Sox.
No, it wasn't 1919. And to the cherry blossoms and the Red Sox winning the World Series, the Titanic sunk.
1911. It bobbed around for a while before.
12 hours.
You mean,
sunk the first time?
Yeah, sunk the first time.
Oh my
first God. Time it went down. You know when it was?
It was after 1910.
It was 1922. No, I am sorry to say, other side, you want to take a shot?
11 or 12, but it's...
Does the scorekeeper know?
1918.
No.
No.
It is 1912.
1912.
It went down. You were thinking of the last time the Sox won, but this was the time before that.
As all right, let's try these. I would like to honorably abdicate at this point.
No.
I'm afraid
Tony
you look
was
at this
absolutely
score.
Right. It had to do with Japanese American relations because it was the original cherry trees were a gift from the government of Japan in gratitude for President Theodore Roosevelt's having helped to settle the Russo-Japanese
yeah,
War.
That's right.
But that was 1904.
Right.
But the war
they,
go on
it took
that
them a while. They had to
while.
Save up.
You know how long it takes for a cherry tree
they were
to
on
get
the Titanic.
Back
and forth. It took a long time to get back and forth. Got to walk back
they
from the Pacific,
ship
the Atlantic Ocean.
The first shipment of the trees died. They were infected with a fungus.
Ah, is that right? We understand from the audience that the first shipment of cherry trees died.
Russo-Japanese thing.
Yeah, they had a fungus, and they had to ship a second one. Okay, well. And Lenore, try this one. What year is involved? Great Britain recognizes the Franco government in Spain.
Oh, wow.
33?
35? And this is way out of my league. I was hoping to get something about the Bee Gees.
Didn't happen.
Give us number two.
No. We got to make a
take
guess.
A guess.
All right.
Say 35.
Well, I was going to say 36, but...
1936 is not right. To recognizing the Franco government, Steinbeck publishes The Grapes of Wrath.
Oh.
No.
37?
I said 37.
No, wait a minute. 1939?
It is 1939.
Wow.
Very good job. Nice job. 7 points for that. You get 7 points for that. And Barry, you get the hardest one of them all, but just give it a shot. The film Nanook of the North is released.
What do you say, 1917? Want to make that as a guess?
I was real early. Yeah. Maybe even turn of the century.
No, it's not turn of the century.
1917.
1917 is a great guess. It is not correct, unfortunately.
Okay.
To Nanook of the North, add King Tut's tomb is opened.
Oh, well, that clarifies.
That was 9-6.
And I covered that.
Yeah.
Saturdays, I
they've
think
they've been
it
trying
was 8
to do
to
it
11.
All this time. They're so, trying to uncover it, and you covered it. Yeah.
That must have been before World War I.
It was in the 20s.
No, after World War I. After World War I was safely settled. Mm-hmm. 1921.
Oh, yep. Brutal. Oh, it is not 1921.
It's 22.
And to King Tut's tomb, we add the Teapot Dome scandal began.
1922
is, in fact, the year. Very nice job, you guys. 4 points for that. 4 points for that.
Rather than show the score, the entire side is prepared to commit hari-kari. In front of the radio audience.
I have to say, on a very difficult day, a 64-point score is a really good score for Tony Khan's team, but it wasn't even in the ballpark. 99 points for this week's winners, Carolyn Perry Fox's team. That is... little canine approval from the back of the room.
That dog can visit me in my dressing room.
There you go. That's all we have time for in Vermont. Thanks so much good to job. Tim Link and all the folks here at the Basin Harbor Club, to Ty Robertson, Robin Turnow, and all our good friends at Vermont Public Radio for their long friendship. Sher and Salkind are the writers. Antonio Oliart mans the meters. And Zach Moore is the associate producer and webmaster. And once every few weeks, we remind you that this show is best when we get your questions, when we get your comments, and when you show up. Thanks, Vermont, for showing up. See you next week. Support for Says You in Vermont comes from the good folks at Vermont Public Radio and the Basin Harbor Club, celebrating 125 years of hospitality on the shores of Lake Champlain. On the web at basinharbor.com. You can hear Says You again for free on any of the stations that stream our show. Just follow the High Definitions radio stations link on our website, find a convenient time, and listen again and again. For copies of this show or any other in our history, you can find downloads at saysyou.net. Just follow that show downloads link and find high-quality copies available. Benjamin, give him the skinny.
Says You, created and produced by Pippin and Finch, Boston.
Listener support makes our service possible. Make a contribution to Nashville Public Radio today, and you'll have a chance to win an 8-day trip for two to Ireland during our Spring E-Pledge. The drawing is coming up Friday morning at 10 o'clock. Pledge now at WPLN.org. Vanderbilt Impact Symposium presents Dimensions of Peace and Conflict, featuring former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and former Senator George Mitchell, who served as U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace. Both Barak and Mitchell will participate in a discussion with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Moranis as moderator, March 18th, 7:30 p.m. in Langford Auditorium. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Lamech Bowie will speak at 7 p.m. March 19th in Langford Auditorium. Both events are open to the public.
This is 90.3 WPLN, Nashville Public Radio, 91.5 WTML, Tullahoma, and 91.7 WHRS, Cookeville. You can find a complete schedule of all our programs and listen to a live stream of any of our program channels at WPLN.org. It's 10 o'clock.
Today's episode of Studio